And welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And this morning we are discussing gun violence in America. And our first guest on that conversation this morning will discuss how President Biden and Congress are responding to the recent back-to-back mass shootings we've had this month. Colby Itkowitz is a national politics reporter for The Washington Post. She's been covering the latest on this issue, and she joins us now. Colby, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so following the second mass shooting in a week, President Biden and Democrats on Capitol Hill called for fast action to enact stricter gun laws. What kind of action are they talking about?
Sure. Well, even before these shootings, the House had passed two universal background checks, which is something that's wildly popular among the American public, but has evaded Congress for the better part of a decade. Basically, what that means is any loophole in background checks when you purchase a firearm would be closed. Private sales, gun shows. And so that passed the House. It's kind of sitting in the Senate, seeing if it can get the necessary 60 votes that you need in the Senate to pass anything these days. And what remains to be seen is, can that happen when you have a 50-50 divided Senate? And right now the prospects are pretty dim, considering you have a lot of, conservative Democrats from gun-favoring states like Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Kristen Sinema in Arizona. It's going to be hard to get them to sign on to something that sounds like you're trying to restrict gun ownership.
And Colby, the President Biden, has spent a lot of his career in the Senate, called on senators to pass a ban on assault weapons and to close these background check loopholes that you're talking about. Here's a bit of what he had to say last week.
The United States Senate, I hope some are listening, should immediately pass the two House-passed bills that close loopholes in the background check system. These are bills that receive votes of both Republicans and Democrats in the House. This is not and should not be a partisan issue. This is an American issue. It will save lives, American lives, and we have to act.
So, Colby, for people who aren't familiar with them, what does President Biden mean when he talks about closing background check loopholes that you were saying are favored by a majority of Americans?
Right. So if you go into a licensed store to buy a gun, there is a mandatory background check that is done on you to make sure that you don't have a criminal history, that you're allowed to own a firearm. Now, there are ways around that, there are these things called gun shows where private dealers will show up with their assortment of guns and sell their guns, and there's no requirement there that they do a background check on you first. There's obviously private sales between people over the internet, maybe even sales between friends and family. And so what the government is trying to do is make sure that there's no way that anyone who's not supposed to have a gun, whether that be because of a criminal background or because of a severe mental health issue, can get their hands on a gun.
Mm-hmm. Colby, how is it that those loopholes exist in the first place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. When background check laws were first created, I mean, laws all the time have loopholes, right? They don't think about the fact that people are going to find their way around these things. And so when they were originally written, they were written for gun sale, people that sell guns, people that are licensed firearm sales owners. And they didn't take into consideration the fact that there would be these person-to-person private sales that could go on. Obviously, they weren't thinking about the internet and all the different ways that people can trade goods and services like they can now. And so you are seeing that a lot of people are getting their guns that way, particularly those who maybe wouldn't be able to walk into a store and buy one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Washington Post national politics reporter Colby Itkowitz about how President Biden and Congress are responding to these back-to-back mass shootings we've experienced this month. As we know, Democrats control Congress. They have the slimmest of majorities in the Senate, with the vice president accounting for that, and obviously the presidency as well. You mentioned Joe Manchin, of course. He's a Democrat of West Virginia. He's a key player in all of this. What's he saying?
Well, it's so interesting about Joe Manchin is that he's been a key player for a long time. Now, I don't know if you'll remember, if your listeners will remember, but back, right after the Sandy Hook shooting that killed, a bunch of 5 and 6 and 7 year olds in Connecticut, Joe Manchin was the one that kind of took up the issue of gun safety, of background checks. He teamed with a Republican from Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, and the two of them teamed up to try and pass what they considered kind of responsible background check laws. And even with a conservative Democrat and a conservative Republican, they could not get the votes to pass it back in 2013. And so whether or not Joe Manchin tries to bring that up again remains to be seen. One thing that Joe Manchin is not going to support, though, is an assault weapon ban. You're not going to see Joe Manchin or many of the conservative Democrats support that. But Joe Manchin could sign up for a background check law, but it remains to be seen how that was written. Joe Manchin would need to see the specifics and make sure there was language written into the Manchin-Toomey bill that was very NRA favorable. And you'll excuse me, I don't remember the details, but they worked with the NRA to make sure the NRA would be okay with the language. And in the end, the NRA still wasn't okay with it, but they tried very hard to placate the NRA when they were writing that bill in 2013.
In recent years, the NRA has had some struggles. Are they the powerful lobbying group they once were?
They're not. And you've really seen these gun safety, anti-gun violence groups rise up and have as much power in terms of their fundraising prowess, their membership. These groups have an incredible amount of money. You saw people in 2018, 2020 run on anti-gun platforms, which is something that was almost unheard of in the last 10, 15 years, and win. And so the NRA is weakened. They've had a lot of financial problems. They've had a lot of corruption problems within their organization. But there is still a sense among members of Congress who are afraid to go up against them. And so it is going to take a while to shift that in the minds of members of Congress who have been there a long time and who have lived their entire careers afraid of the NRA.
President Biden also said last week that this is not and should not be a partisan issue. It is an American issue, as he put it. Has this always been partisan, and what's the history there?
It has this level of partisanship around gun safety has not been. And in 1994, an assault weapon ban was passed in this country, and it was the law for 10 years. Americans could not buy an assault weapon, a gun that's meant for war, that can kill multiple people in one shot. And that there's no reason why a person should have to have a gun like that. And so a large number of people seem to be in agreement that there was no need for the average American to have a military style weapon. Handgun, a rifle for hunting, fine, but not an assault weapon. But that expired in 2004 under George Bush, when the NRA really kicked up and started fighting back. It hurt sales, right? I mean, these things are expensive to purchase. They're worth a lot of money. And so it really everything kind of comes down to finances and money, right? And so it lost the money. And so they fought really hard against this ban and they won. And there has not been the political will to get that ban back in place since.
All right. Colby Itkowitz is a national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for your update on what's happening, with lawmakers right now around this issue.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. You are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are talking about gun violence and efforts to legislate gun ownership in the U.S. and how the issue of guns has unfolded during the past year, during the pandemic, especially recently following these back-to-back mass shootings in Boulder, Colorado, and the Atlanta area that left a total of 18 people dead. According to the Gun Violence Archive, nearly 20,000 people died by gun violence in 2020, an increase of more than 30% from the previous year. And that number, it does not include suicides. Here in California, the Office of the State Attorney General is withholding gun violence data from a state-funded research institution specifically tasked by lawmakers to evaluate California's firearms regulations. The AG's office is also directing universities to destroy records the agency previously released. That agency is the UC Davis California Firearm Violence Research Center, and researchers have been saying that for several years now, the California Department of Justice has made it increasingly difficult to access data only it maintains, despite a legal mandate to provide the records. This only adds to the overall lack of data that exists on gun violence in the state, let alone the country. Dr. Garen Wintemute is an emergency medicine physician and director of the Violence Prevention Research Center at UC Davis. Dr. Wintemute joins us now, and welcome back to Insight. Nice to have you on the show.
Thanks, Randall. Good morning.
Well, you're certainly considered the expert in this area. The state legislature in 2016 passed a law to establish and fund the UC Davis California Firearm Violence Research Center. Doctor, tell us first about the center and why this got passed several years back.
Sure. As you've described it, the center is a state-funded research and teaching program focused on firearm violence. It's the first in the country. Some others have been set up in emulation of it. It was established for a couple of reasons, I think. One is that this is a state that understands that government has a role in solving problems. And this is a government that recognizes the value of science to that problem solving. That's reason number one. Reason number two is that the group here at Davis had already been doing the work for about 30 years at that time. And the state recognized we've got a center of excellence, functionally speaking. There's been a huge national problem getting funding for the research. So let's fix the funding problem and give the experts what they need to do the job.
Yeah. And so what kind of data does the center collect?
So the center makes use of data collected by the Justice Department, mm-hmm. Technical point. But the data that the Justice Department collects that we have used for research are purchase records for purchases of firearms, criminal history records. More recently, we've made use of the records for something called the Armed and Prohibited Persons Program. In California, if somebody's bought a gun legally in the past, but they've just done something that's made them prohibited from owning it, been convicted of a violent crime, let's say, the state has a mechanism to go out and try and recover the guns from those people to prevent violence in the future. And we have used all of those records, some of them going back to 1990.
Mm-hmm. And so there is an overall dearth of data in the U.S. when it comes to gun violence. Why is that? Why is it so difficult to do the research that you yourself are working on?
So first off, apologies for the background noise. My office is across from the hospital. Good question. My take is that that's by design. I listened in on your prior interview. Here's the thinking. If research might lead to conclusions that would harm the interests of the industry or the users of the product, let's choke off the research, whether that's a matter of not collecting data in the first place or preventing the release of the data, which is done routinely at the federal level, not just here in California, or making it difficult or impossible to get funding to do the work. Whatever method is available, let's keep the science from being done. Problem with that, if I may, is it's as if we had decided, let's not do research on the coronavirus pandemic. Let's not do research on cancer or heart disease. Let's just let these problems run their course. The problem with that is people die as health problems run their course. And as you mentioned, we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 people dying every year from firearm violence. I mean, one last point and I'll stop. In the last 10 years, we have had more civilians die from firearm violence in the United States than we had combat casualties from World War II and Vietnam put together.
I guess the difference between the examples you gave, coronavirus and cancer and guns, is that nobody's selling different brands of cancer or different brands of coronavirus, and it's not written into the Constitution that you are you have the right to have those diseases.
You are correct on both points. Firearms are consumer products. Ammunition is a consumer product. And there is an industry that sees its interest threatened by research that might in some way affect demand for that product or affect the ability to supply it.
So in 2017, after Javier Becerra took office as the state's attorney general, you've said that you noticed a stark difference in how the Department of Justice handled the center's data applications. What changes did you notice?
Projects were not being renewed, although there was no reason not to renew them. They were projects underway, in some cases, projects funded initially by the Justice Department. Requests for data went unanswered. And that went on for quite some time. We heard indirectly that data were not going to be supplied. In the legislation that originally created the center, there was a mandate to provide the data necessary to do the research. We worked with the legislature to get that mandate toughened. In the case of records of gun violence restraining orders, which I didn't mention earlier, we also worked with those records. Despite that toughened mandate, the Department of Justice ceased providing all of the gun violence restraining order data that we needed in order to do a careful evaluation of this policy. And the logic is really simple. Here's a new violence prevention policy. California, not surprisingly, is the first state in the nation to enact that policy. We need to know if it works. There's really only one good way to do that. And despite a mandate, DOJ stopped providing the data needed to do that careful evaluation.
And what reasonings do they give for halting access to that data?
Well, for a very long time, they refused to talk about the problem. Requests to meet and try and work it out were simply not responded to. In the case of the gun violence restraining orders, as pressure has grown, they have said publicly, well, this is a privacy issue. But the data are already public. It's a technical matter. But the data that DOJ has that we are asking for are already in the public domain. So privacy is really not a tenable argument. There has been speculation by others that this may have something to do with a tendency toward secrecy on the part of the leadership of the agency more broadly. Research on controlled substances has also been affected in the ways we are describing.
And so I guess then you've adjusted, you're still able to do your work because you're able to get the data in a different manner?
Yeah, we have had to scale back or redesign studies in order to make work of the projects. Make the projects work with the data that we have. Some projects are quite simply on hold in hope of a resolution. We've had some other good ideas that we haven't bothered to develop because there's no assurance we could get the data. In some ways, the program has been halted by this. We are also working with the legislature. There is a bill, AB 1237, that's been introduced in the legislature in an effort to fix this problem long term.
Dr. Wintemute, who is directing these actions, with Becerra now serving as the nation's Secretary of Health and Human Services?
Well, as you mentioned, Attorney General Becerra is no longer. He's now Secretary of Becerra. And at least some of his executive leadership team has moved with him to Washington. There will very shortly be a new attorney general. We expect it will be Assemblymember Bonta. I think probably members of the legislature will seek discussions with the nominee or bring it up during the process of the confirmation. From my point of view, I'm a scientist. I'm interested in generating the data to help make good policy and save lives. And And we will work with whomever we need to in order to get this resolved and forward.
Yeah. Based on Bonta's record, are you optimistic moving forward?
Well, I'm optimistic if we talk about his general positions, and he's been good on policy matters related to firearm violence. This is a pleading of ignorance. I don't have a good sense on his position with regard to data sharing and so forth. I've heard nothing in either direction from people who are closer to his record.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm Randall White, and we are speaking about gun violence in the United States following, of course, some mass shootings that happened earlier this month, a couple of them. Dr. Garen Wintemute is an emergency medicine physician and director of the Violence Prevention Research Center at UC Davis. So as a whole, doctor, what has the issue of gun violence and mass shootings looked like in the country since the pandemic began? We didn't see mass shootings in the headlines as often because coronavirus was dominating the headlines. But what does the data say?
Yep. Let's tease it apart a little bit. There have, over the last year, been a decline in frequency of the large-scale public mass shootings, the ones that get place names that we all can recite now. But those big public events not only account for a very small portion of people who die from gun violence, they don't even account for most mass shootings. Most mass shootings are private events. A large percentage involve domestic violence. And the rate of those events was really not affected. They're just not handled the same way by the media. No criticism there, but we're just less aware of them. And as you reported earlier, rates of firearm violence overall went up, not down during the pandemic. And there's lots of thoughts about why. Early on, roughly a year ago, there was a run-up in gun purchasing. And we know from prior research that those surges in purchasing are followed generally by surges in violence. And we saw that happening in the later spring, April and May. And then came the end of May and George Floyd's killing and other events. There were protests, reactions to those protests. Rates of violence increased during the summer. Rates of purchasing increased during the summer. And then we saw something that we have not seen before, ever. And that was a dramatic and sustained increase in the rate of gun purchasing that rose in the fall, continued right through November and December, as we had a continuation of a violence in the community. Then we had an election season.
Could the election have been part of that driving?
Yeah, no question about it. People buy guns for two reasons, both having to do with fear. One is personal protection. I'm going to protect my family. It's a myth, but it still drives a lot of purchases. But the other is people buy because they think, gee, we might have a Democratic president coming, and that happened. And we might see efforts to control the purchase of firearms. And as you've been discussing today, that's happening. So people buy strategically. But yes, we had a contested election. We had predictions of civil disturbance. We had an assault on the Capitol at the incitement, I would argue, of the sitting president at the time. And purchasing has only just recently tapered off. So there has been a huge increase over expected numbers in gun purchasing in the last year. And we are about to live through whatever the effects of that are going to be. That's still in our future.
Doctor, does your research show whether gun laws make a difference? California has some of the strictest gun laws, if not the strictest gun laws in the nation. How do our numbers stack up when it comes to, you know, gun violence?
Sure. So I'm going to give an umbrella answer. We can talk about specific laws if you want. But the umbrella answer is that, yes, gun laws work. California has, if we rank states from top to bottom on homicide rates, California's 29. It's below average for homicide. It's something like 45 out of 50 for suicide. We have very low firearm suicide rates. I'll give you two examples of laws that we think make a difference, and there are more. One is we prevent the purchase of firearms by essentially everyone who's been convicted of a violent crime for at least 10 years following that purchase. In most of the country, it's just a myth that people with violent crimes on their record can't buy guns. They can't. The other is that we require a background check for essentially all purchases of a firearm. There's lots of variation in those laws across the state, or excuse me, across the country, but particularly in states where not just a background check, but a permit is required, there's substantial evidence of effectiveness.
So when we hear about national efforts to close these loopholes, that's already been done here in California?
In many cases, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, Dr. Garen Wintemute is an emergency medicine physician and director of the Violence Prevention Research Center at UC Davis. Thank you so much for joining us today and updating us on the situation with this data collection and also where we stand with gun violence a year into the pandemic.
Sure, Randall. Thanks for having me.
Much appreciated. Always a pleasure to have you on. A gunman shot and killed 10 people last week at a King Soopers grocery store in Boulder, Colorado. 6 days prior, another shooter killed 8 people at Atlanta area spas, 6 of whom were women of Asian descent. In all, there have been 7 mass killings this year, which is defined as 4 or more dead, not including the killer. News organizations have to walk a fine line when it comes to navigating sensitive information surrounding these incidents, such as disclosing the killer's identity. Andrew Kenny is a public affairs reporter for Colorado Public Radio. He joins us now with more on how he and his newsroom went about covering the recent shooting in Boulder. Welcome to Insight, Andrew. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, what were your thoughts when you first learned of this shooting in Boulder?
In the worst way, I saw this unfolding on a video live stream that was shot by an amateur, I guess you could call him journalist, who was in the parking lot capturing the entire SWAT response. So I watched this unfold in real time and knew from what I was seeing that it was going to be really, really horrible. And of course, Colorado has a long history with these kind of terrible mass shootings. So unfortunately, our newsroom was pretty well prepared for what came next.
All right. Do you live in Boulder?
I live in Arvada. It's about 25 minutes away, 30 minutes.
Yeah. So your newsroom was prepared based on the cinema shooting and then also Columbine, which we all recall, of course. What sort of things do you have in place that were learned from those experiences?
I think that the thing that was most evident in local media in general's response to this shooting was, I would hope, a somewhat more compassionate response. I hope that we did a much better job of focusing on the grief and the human impact and not, I have the impression that during Columbine, I mean, I was only 12 years old during Columbine, but I have the impression that the shooters were much more the focus in that early coverage. It was a much more, you know, this questioning of, oh, who were these guys? Why did they do this? And I feel that most of the local coverage in this tragedy has been focused on the lives lost. And to the extent that it's been about the shooter, it's been more systemic, looking at how did he get the gun? What safety nets could or did not catch what was coming?
Mm-hmm.
So I would hope that we've done a better job there.
And you're so right about that with the Columbine incident. I can think of the killer's names right now, right off the top of my head. This new one that happened in Boulder happened so recently, and I can't think of that killer's name. So that does show a major shift in the way that it's covered.
Yeah, I think I could probably name all 10 of the victims right now. And maybe that's a function of what I've been focused on, which has been talking to mostly their friends, their coworkers, survivors. And I think that is in large part what the audience is interested to hear more about. I think people are exhausted of only hearing about the single perpetrators and not hearing about, you know, each one of these deaths is going to resonate for so many years. And that's what we've been learning and really absorbing through our coverage. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a crucial function of what media can do in the immediate aftermath when we don't know all the details of how this happened again, is that we can help people process their grief in a social way, because the grief is real for all of us.
Andrew, how do you go about arranging for and collecting those interviews with people who have had their lives turned upside down because of this tragic event, and not disrupt their lives anymore in the process?
That is a really good question. And it's one where, again, I hope that we've done a better job, but I know that media has not been perfect here. One thing is that Boulder police have taken a more proactive role in assigning a media liaison to each of the families. And so after the first day when, you know, everyone rushed to cover the individual lives, there's now a more structured approach, which I think a lot of people are using. I think that's actually a good development, is to have that more formal way to do that. Beyond that, you know, I've gone through union representatives to find people. I haven't been doing a ton of door knocking or cold calling. So it's been a fairly structured approach, and I think that's been helpful.
We're going to talk to a psychiatrist in just a little bit about the effects of this type of violence. As a reporter, how do you keep what you're covering from affecting you on those levels?
I don't think that you do. I mean, I think that I would be worried if it didn't affect me. That would be what really frightens me. I don't know. I came from a family where, you know, both of my parents dealt with grief pretty early in their lives with the loss of parents. And it's something that was present in our lives. And I think that that gave me a bit of a toolkit for dealing with it. I volunteered at a camp for bereaved kids with my mom. And that just kind of gave me the language to speak it and to, you know, to the extent that I can, to share some of those feelings. I know it'll never be the same as even an order of magnitude as what those affected are feeling. But I think we do have to feel it and acknowledge it, but also, you know, keep our professional roles and just try to keep some balance.
Mm-hmm. Does the station give you tools to deal with this for people that, you know, maybe aren't as prepared as you are, it sounds like?
I hope so. I know that we have a lot of new hires and younger people who have been on the story who haven't dealt with this. And the station has made available certain resources. Mental health appointments are available. And I've been doing what I can to keep those lines of communication open, because it is a really awful experience, you know, for the reporters as well.
Mm-hmm. What's the mood like in Boulder right now? I lived there for a couple of years, and I love that town. You know,
yeah, me too.
Visited multiple times after moving away. And I always think of Boulder as being a pretty upbeat place. But can you sense a difference, a change?
It's hard to say. I've not been through a story where something of this scale, a shooting of this scale, has happened so close to home. Maybe this happens, of course, with every one of these, but there is this feeling among everyone I know that, you know, this is a grocery store that we all pass on our way up to the foothills.
I've been to that King Supers. Mm-hmm.
It's been there for 50 years. You know, speaking to the people who worked there, the employees tend to be really long tenured. So I, you know, my sister-in-law knew or recognized one of the employees who was killed, and she's not lived in Colorado for many years now. So I think that level of personal connection and familiarity is what makes these mass shootings have a psychological and immediate impact that, of course, the everyday toll of gun violence, which we should also acknowledge, as your previous guest did, it can have that outsized impact because of the familiarity.
And I guess part of the trauma that the town is experiencing is this, you know, onslaught of media coverage that, you mm-hmm. know, comes with it. So I guess it sounds like Colorado public media is doing a good job of treading lightly in that area. But how would you rate media coverage as a whole when it comes to the shooting?
We've certainly seen some frustration and pushback from Boulder Police Department. Just this morning, they tweeted that they were pretty mad about certain reporters, they didn't say who, crossing lines in continuing to message bereaved families. They then deleted that tweet and apologized and said that, you know, most of us are handling this with empathy and with sympathy, but that, you know, they are obviously on edge as well. The police department, they lost one of their own officers. So I right. guess if you would ask the police and the survivors, it would probably be a mixed report card for us. I've tried to do a better job of, you know, practicing kind of an informed consent of talking with people and giving them more off ramps to cancel the interview and to say, I don't want to do this, or to say, this is actually harming me. So I think I will make an effort at the end of this to touch back with people and see what effect we had. My colleague Nathaniel Miner did an excellent series about the aftermath of Columbine recently. And what he told me was that he suffered tremendous anxiety, doing that, one, hearing how badly people were traumatized by media attention 22 years ago now. And I think that having that perspective of the aftermath of that earlier tragedy can help us now, seeing what the long-term effects of our own actions were.
Andrew, is there any sense there in Colorado as to why that state tends to, specifically the Front Range, tends to have these really high-profile mass shootings?
It's hard to say. I don't have a definitive answer. I know that the Denver Post did an analysis and found that the metro area is quite high per capita on shootings. There are numerous smaller ones as well that most people nationally wouldn't even have heard of. Mm-hmm. The suicide rate in Colorado and a lot of Western states is quite high as well. Comparatively, we're in the top 5 or 10, I believe. Mm-hmm. I do not know. I mean, a prevalence of firearms may contribute, but I couldn't say more than that.
Yeah. Well, keep up the good work. We really appreciate what you're doing. Andrew Kenny is a public affairs reporter for Colorado Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this morning and sharing your experience in this, what's been, I guess, a horrific week for you.
Thank you for having me.
Still ahead, we look at the long-term effects of these mass shootings, how they're changing us and how they've changed our culture. We're joined by a professor of psychiatry who studies the negative effects of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. If you have thoughts on this, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org, or use the Twitter hashtag #AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are talking about what gun violence has looked like during the pandemic. And earlier this month, of course, back-to-back mass shootings occurred in both Boulder, Colorado, and the Atlanta area, leaving a total of 18 people dead. Mass shootings have risen dramatically over the past 2 decades and have become a new norm of sorts, begging the questions of, how are they changing us? How are they changing our country? And what about our culture? Well, Dr. Arash Javanbach is an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Wayne State University School of Medicine in Michigan, where he studies the negative effects of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Javanbach, thank you so much for being here on Insight.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So mass shootings over time have become somewhat of a norm in our society. We just saw two this month. How did we get to this point, in your opinion?
Well, it's hard for me to say how we got here, because in terms of like why mass shootings are happening at this level, I mean, one issue is that in other societies, there might be people who are like, who do such wrong things without a clear reason, but the tools they have are much less lethal. So probably when you hear the news, you hear someone stabbed one or two people in the neighborhood. But then here, someone is able with the strong tool that they're given in their hands, kill a very large number of people. But how do we get here as a society of feeling more comfortable with these things? I mean, as humans, we get used to anything. We can get desensitized if anything is repeated to us, to the point that we do not even at times see the ugliness of the issue. Imagine you are in an environment where there is bad smell. In the beginning, when you step in, you really hate it. But if you stay there for 5-10 days, that becomes norm. You don't even smell it.
Are we at the point in the U.S. where we're not smelling the effects of gun violence anymore?
I mean, hoping not. Well, in reality, if you were in another country where there's not such a big access, such easy access to firearms, and you hear one person grabbed a gun and went to a restaurant and killed 20 people, probably that would be a huge shock on the society, and society would think about what could be done in terms of the changes and how to prevent it and how to protect us against it. But when it keeps repeating itself, it becomes like, okay, as you've heard a lot from people, they're using the analogy of all their cars and their car accidents and people die. Mm-hmm. It becomes kind of like that. And it depends also a lot on how we frame it to the people and not let it become, not give it like such metaphors that, oh, okay, so this is something that we have to go through because guns are necessary. Like, I don't know, military grade guns are necessary for people just for fun, mm-hmm. just for leisure. So although I'm not an expert in guns, so I would rather more talk about the trauma.
Yeah, and that's where you are indeed an expert. You wrote last week for The Conversation about how mass shootings leave emotional and mental scars on survivors, first responders, and then millions of others who, you know, see it on TV or listen to it on their local NPR station. Walk us through that and the psychological impacts that you're seeing in your research.
Yeah, so when we are exposed to extremely traumatic situations, basically by that we mean situations that can severely damage one's physical or emotional integrity. Situations like shooting, like robbery, like war, natural disasters, rape, assault. These situations are extremely traumatic and then can lead to what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, which means that the person will be always terrified. The brain basically switched to fight and flight mode, and you're always screening the environment for danger, frequent nightmares, flashbacks. People tend to avoid any reminder of the trauma, and then depression and anxiety follows. This is a very debilitating case. And of course, a lot of people do not pass that diagnostic threshold, but still have the problems, still have the anxiety, still might avoid their neighborhood or environment. I even have cops who avoid a specific neighborhood because there they were exposed to shooting of a child that is really traumatic and painful to them. So the first group is the people who have been in the vicinity and the people who were basically survivors, people who have survived, whether they were physically injured or not, they have been exposed to a risk of, okay, I'm gonna die right now. And those people and their families have high chance of developing what we call post-traumatic stress disorder or lower level of symptoms, up to 1 in 3 people. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, when you say a high percentage of those people that had direct exposure to the violence, what are we talking about? And you, what is it, 1 in 3, did you say?
Yeah, and 1 in 3, different studies show different data based on, well, of course, the number of people, the intensity of the exposure, because not every shooting is the same. But in general, when the perpetrator of the trauma is human, let's say a shooting versus natural disaster, the chance of developing PTSD is much higher because we are social creatures. And that's like up to like 1 in 3 people that we talk about are those who pass the threshold, which means they have all the symptoms. There will be a lot of other people who have lower levels of symptoms. Let's say they don't have the nightmares, but they are still avoiding going to in that area, or they still are nervous going to school. So these people and their families may sustain all these symptoms of trauma that can be very debilitating, although I don't want to portray a very dark picture, because these are treatable conditions, and that's the good news. If they are caught early enough, we have effective treatments. There's also survival guilt for a lot of people, and I see it a lot, especially in first responders or people who have survived, and a friend or a colleague, like veterans, did not survive. For long, they can impact the person feeling and thinking about, okay, why did I survive? What could I have done to help the other person, although they're totally innocent in that.
Yeah. Could I have done more? Mm-hmm. You can always walk back those things in your head and you know, it's hard to judge someone and what they did right then in the moment. Does age make a difference? How old you are when you experience this trauma?
We don't have data that shows it makes a huge difference. We know both children and adults are similarly vulnerable to trauma. With children, it's more, it's a little bit more difficult. The case is more difficult because they're in a very plastic stage of life, and childhood trauma can impact the rest of their life because that's the time I'm learning about the world and the universe. And I will develop a learning that world is a very unsafe place. We have a ton of data showing childhood trauma prones people to adult development of PTSD, depression, substance use, obesity, cardiovascular illness, pain. So in children specifically, it's important. It's important to be attended.
Doctor, in about a minute that we have left here, I want to put the lens back on us here in the media. You wrote that the media's role and how it can be good, it can be bad, and sometimes it can be downright ugly. What is the role in the media in how we perceive these events, and maybe we get sort of a distanced effect of trauma?
Yeah, so, and unfortunately, a lot of times, so it's good for the media to give us the information, right? If I don't know these things are happening in my society, I will not pick up the phone and call my representative or lawmaker or try to be active and like think about ways of resolving this pandemic of shootings. But at the same time, some media focus on the emotionality of it, right? Kind of a disaster pornography component. That how everything is terrible and keep repeating and repeating and repeating and hammering it to the point that people believe that, oh, if you're in Colorado right now, you're absolutely unsafe and you have to hunker down, right? By one shooting that happened in a corner of that that big city. We don't want to create that false, exaggerated sense of uncertainty and sense of unsafeness for people because that can be traumatic. There's data that shows people can be traumatized even via hearing the news.
Right. Dr. Arash Javanbakht is an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Wayne State University School of Medicine in Michigan. Doctor, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this with us.
It was a pleasure. You have a good day.
You too. And that is Insight for today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Randall White. Thanks for joining us today. We'll catch you back here tomorrow, Tuesday, when we discuss the rise in Northern California cities experimenting with guaranteed minimum income. Former Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs joins us for that discussion. Make it a great day.